Cole, and we're at, for the first time, the third, located by the Columbia Lakefront. And I'm here with my co-host, Candace Dodson-Reed. Candace, you set us up with a new spot.
I did. I wanted us to come support Laura Bacon, who has been wonderful and who started the Third and owns and operates the Third. They had a fantastic art show here called WOCAX this weekend. It was three days of art.
I know one of the artists.
Yes, I had some art displayed there, and that was my first art show, and I was really proud to do it, and really thankful for both Marlin and Laura, who came up with the idea, who curated the artists. There were 12 artists who were absolutely fabulous, all women of color. And it was just exciting, and it was a whole vibe down here on downtown on the lakefront. And so that was exciting. And so thank you to Laura for opening up the space again for us tonight.
Yeah, and I've had the opportunity to spend time with you this weekend as you were going back and forth here, and one, to just see how excited you were. You know,
yeah.
Candace, I will say that you normally keep an even keel. Like, even when you're excited, it's still on an even keel. You could tell you were excited.
Yeah.
But then also, you are not easily impressed. And you were impressed by what happened here. And so
for sure.
I would recommend all of you, just even if you can't go into the space yet because it's not open, they have these really cool QR codes on the window. And while we've been setting up for the show, we have seen people come by and do the QR codes to donate money to the Third. So come check it out. We got a little bit of a tour here today with the County Executive Sherm Baker. And this place is going to be awesome when
it's
it
gonna
opens
be awesome.
In July.
Truly awesome.
So,
thank
Candace,
you
want to formally introduce our guest? I'm so excited about this show.
I am also excited. We have a highly anticipated show with someone who many would describe as the epicenter of Maryland politics as of June 2022, and that's Rashern Baker. Rashern was the Prince George's County Executive from 2010 to 2018, and before that served as a state delegate from 1994 to 2003. Since leaving office in December 2018, Baker has successfully launched a National Leadership Institute for local government chief executives in consultation with the University of Maryland School of Public Policy and the County Executives America. Baker is the president and CEO of the Baker Strategy Group, a consulting firm providing strategic operational solutions to a variety of public, private sector, and nonprofit clients throughout the Washington, D.C. region. Baker also serves on several boards, including the University of Maryland Medical System, the Alzheimer's Association, and the Junior Tennis Champions Center. In April of 2021, Baker announced his bid for the 2022 Democratic nomination for governor. He was one of the most prominent candidates to utilize the public financing system, which relies on small dollar donors and matching funds. Despite polling in the top tier of candidates throughout the cycle, earlier this month, Baker announced that he would be suspending his campaign due to lack of funds. Since that time, there's been significant speculation about who will receive the support of one of Maryland's most prominent political figures. Welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you on.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And I love this spot that we're in. This is amazing. And of course, as a father of two artists, I love any time that there's an art show and people are actually buying art. So,
yes.
And congratulations to you for your show, Candace.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that. So you know where we're going to start. Will you endorse and when? And here's the better question. Can you give us a hint about who that will be? Will the name be
news.
Like a Tom, a Wes, John, Peter? What do we have, County Executive?
Jerome Siegel called me, so he wants to know if I'm going to endorse him. So definitely a shout out to him. You know, it was a hard decision not to continue with the campaign. As you said, we have been in the top tier since the very beginning. We were polling a strong second throughout. Only Peter Francho was polling ahead of us. But we did something different, Nancy Navarro and myself, that has not ever been done by a top-tier Democratic candidate, and that is to try public financing. I wanted to do that because I felt like, as a Democratic Party, this is one of the things that we have advocated for so long. How do you get dark money out of politics? And it's also something I've worked on in the private sector with other executives to say this is what we should be moving toward. But the bottom line is that what we found out is that while as noble as it is, under the current system, it was just impossible to keep up with the millions of dollars that were raised by individuals from around the state. For those who don't know about public financing, is the most you can get from an individual is $250. The only match comes from those who donate in the state of Maryland. And so it prohibited us from actually raising money outside of the state that would then be matched. In the very beginning, of course, of the race, it was fine. But as we got closer to the end, when people were starting to really spend money on TV, which we did, we ran our ads in Baltimore. But it became clear to me in the last 40 days that we were not going to be able to match the millions of dollars that were going to be spent. And I felt like it was, you know, it would be a bit selfish of me to continue if I did not think I could be the nominee and have the resources then to compete in the general. So since then, I suspended the campaign, and a number of people have called. I said I would like to, you know, endorse a candidate that I think can win the primary, but more importantly, win the general. But I want to endorse somebody that shares our values, the things that I've seen throughout this campaign. And so I've talked to all of the candidates. Certainly, there's a top tier. You have Peter Franchot, as I mentioned, who I serve with in the legislature, Wes Moore, who I've gotten to know over the course of the campaign, and Tom Perez, who I've known for a number of years. We go back to before either one of us was in politics. And then two people, and, you know, Doug Gansler, I've known for years. We served together when he was attorney general and I was county executive. And John King, who I've gotten to know and I have a lot of respect for. So my hope is that, you know, we're going to make a final decision on our campaign. We suspended it. We did not withdraw. We're still on the ballot. But we've ceased all activities except for raising money, which is what we said we would try and raise enough money. But I think we'll make a decision no later than Monday of next week as to, one, where our campaign is, and two, if and who we would endorse.
Can I ask just a quick follow-up question?
Yes.
Because I am on the MHA board, and I heard you talk about this on the MHA board, sort of the why you got into the race. And just to give people a little bit of background about sort of your vision and what you may be looking for in the next governor.
Yes. I mean, to me, healthcare was one of the most important issues that I found as an executive. As many people know, I became county executive in 2010 in Prince George's County during a very hard period for the county. But it was also a personally hard period for my family and I. My wife was first diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And so understanding and trying to, you know, deviate around the healthcare system, especially mental behavioral health, became an issue that we personally were dealing with. And then as county executive, when I started to look at the issues that affected the county, whether it was crime, or our education system, behavioral mental health and health became a big issue. And so one of the things that we've pushed, Nancy Navarro and I pushed in this race, was I want someone who's going to be a governor that's going to be active in providing access to quality health care, not only throughout the state, but really emphasizing on the mental and behavioral part of it, because I think that's going to get to, I found it successful as county executive to focus on that and saw the reduction in our public safety, our crime, but we also saw the reduction in dropouts from our schools, truancy from our schools, because we focus on that. And so I've talked to each one of the candidates and said, I want that to be a pillar of what you're going to do, not only during the campaign, but how does that relate in, when you become governor?
And would, sort of bouncing off of that, would you be interested in the next administration serving as a czar in that capacity? Or are you looking to work in the next administration in some way?
No, what I'd like to, and I've said to each one of the candidates, what I want to do is something that I'm doing right now with executives from around the country, is I want to use the experiences that I have as someone who's dealt with a very complex, large, second largest jurisdiction in the state. And how do you actually shape your government, and how do you relate to the local level? Because the governor is going to have to relate to not only the legislative body, which I came from in Annapolis, but you also have to relate to the local. So the county executive, Howard County, the county council, the various municipalities that we have throughout the state. And if you don't understand the relationship that way, then you can't effectively get anything done. So what I've offered to them is to say, hey, whoever is governor, I want to help you. I don't need a position. I don't need to get paid. I just want to make sure we get the best quality government in here. And there are things that, I've learned. And there are also mistakes that I made that I don't want them making at that level. Because we're in a critical moment. I think I said this as the reason I ran. You look at COVID and what has happened with George Floyd is something that at this moment you have to be able to make decisions quickly, and we're going to have to deal with the economy. So
if I could ask a follow-up on that, there is, and this, I think this conflict is throughout the Democratic Party on a national level and on a local level, a seeming conflict between you need experience, you need to have, you need to know how the gears of government work in order to get things done, versus we need new ideas, we need to start over again, you know, the doing the same old that we've always done hasn't solved our problems, so we need to start over. You know, you definitely were in the lane of experience. How do you see that divide, that sort of conflict?
So as somebody who ran on change throughout their career and ran for county executive three times, you know, before finally getting on change, that we need new ideas, you know, when you get in there, you find out that if you don't really know what you're doing, you know, and it harkened me back to, you know, my time as a legislator, Pete Rollins, who was chair of appropriation, really smart, once said to me, he said, you know, you have all these great ideas and you want to do all this stuff, but you don't even know how the legislature works. You can't help anybody unless you know how to get in there and do things. And I found that to be true as county executive, and they'll find it to be true as governor. If you don't actually know how to get a bill from the House to the Senate into your desk, or the fact that if you're going to actually improve health care, you can't do it just from the governor. It's a joint appointment for every health officer throughout our state is jointly appointed by the governor and the county executive or the mayor. Education is controlled by the state. It is one of the things that we have in our constitution, but it's executed at the local level. So unless you understand it, you can go in with all these promises, and there's one of the candidates who I love, always talks about new ideas, and that we do the same thing over and over again. What I wanted to say to that person is, no, we don't. Where we fail as a state and at the local level is we don't really commit to those things. We start them and then we change. And so what I learned as an executive is that you're going to have to commit to ideas. So if you're really committed to healthcare and mental behavioral health like I was, you had to put it in there, put it in the budget, and know that you were going to get pushback. If you're committed to education, like we talk about the blueprint for Maryland, and it's great, but it's 20 years old. We never committed to Thornton in a way that we funded it the way we're talking about the blueprint. And so those are the things I think the experience helps. You want new, and we basically created as county executive what I call our Transforming Neighbors Initiative, brand new program. That we targeted areas that had been forgotten with a holistic approach. So we just didn't look at crime, we looked at all these things. It was a new approach, but once we put the resources in there, we knew how to actually operate the government at the local level and at the state level. And I think that's what the governor is gonna have to do. If you're gonna improve conditions in Baltimore City, you need to know what your powers are and how those powers can be used in coordination. We're here in Howard County. We talked about this incubator right here that we're talking from. Well, it's an opportunity where the Economic Development Office at Howard County could get funds from the Economic Development Office at the state level, and you could expand what you're doing here. Mm-hmm. But you need to know that, and that's what we emphasize.
Yeah, I'd like to go back just a little bit, because normally we start our shows asking people to tell us their story, like the Who is Rashearn Baker story. And I do want to get that and capture that on this. We had to get into the juicy part first, but I definitely want to go back and allow our listeners to learn a little bit more about you. So who is Rashearn Baker?
You know, it's interesting. I normally start a conversation off about how I got to, you know, public service. And the quick version of it, and I didn't you know, say a lot of it in this go round for governor. But the quick version is that, you know, I grew up in the military. My dad, you know, moved around. He was an 82nd Airborne. I was not a particularly good student. And in fact, I repeated the first and second grade. So if you can imagine, you're moving every 2 years, people tease you, and I would get kicked out of these various schools. But what I noticed when I became a teenager, and especially when I came back to the States in the 70s, we lived in Okinawa, Japan for the longest period of time. And then we came back to the States, and for the first time I lived in a civilian school. But I didn't really understand how blessed I was as a human being with these great parents until we came back to the States. I'm in this school. We're the only black family in this area, Massachusetts. And, you know, I was kind of wandering around, but I had a teacher, you know, because all I cared about was sports and maybe going into the Army. And I had a teacher in that school who wouldn't let me slide by. She insisted that I read and do a book report for extra credit to play football. And she gave me, and I used to tell this to students when I was county executive, she gave me the choice to read one or two books. I chose one book. And it was Wuthering Heights or Black Boy.
Okay.
And I counted the pages of Black Boy, and I decided that one. But it changed my life. It let me know that I had been so blessed to have parents, and that the reason that I was able to do these things is because they were always there to support me. And it made me want to do something different with my life. And so my dad was so happy that I was focusing on something other than sports that he and I would watch these political debates. And I would say to him, you know, the local politician who had been there for 20 years, you know, doesn't do anything. The neighbor is still the same. He only comes around when it's election, you know, that's safe. And he, you know, he challenged me. He said, if you could do better, you should run for office. And I said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to prove to you that you can run for office and keep your integrity. And that's at 17 sent me on my way. And it's the thing that's motivated me since then. So I came to the Washington area to go to Howard University because naively I thought, well, politicians are in Washington, right? So I should go to school there. And I've been blessed. I got a chance on my first run to go in the House of Delegates and just see how you could actually see how hard it was. Of course, first of all, you know, I think, you know, I go back to, you know, the guy I talked about, and I was thinking, I owe that guy an apology. It's a lot harder and a lot more nuanced than you think when you're young and excited. And so that kind of led me to what it is, how I wanted to be able to have an impactful change on other people's life in public service. So it was never a particular office. It was, where could I use what I know to have an impactful change? And first it was in judiciary. And then I went over to appropriation, and somebody like Pete Rollins and Wayne Curry, they were just teaching me the dynamics of how you actually, as an executive, could use power to change people's lives. And that led me to want to be county executive. Because I said, if I can be county executive in Prince George's County, given all the problems we have there, but given the opportunities, that's where I could make the most change. And that led me to as my kids say, you know, a life of public service. But I was blessed. I married a woman who believes in public service, did not believe in elective office, but she believed that we should take everything that we've learned and use it to better somebody else's life and give people the same opportunities that we had. And that's something we try to instill in our children, is that it doesn't matter what you do, but you should be making sure everybody has that. So quality education, you know, healthcare, all of those things should have an impact on you. And so for us to close it, you know, my wife's condition, as county executive, I had access to some of the best medical advice you could pay for or not pay for. It was right there. I had people who could help us. And so we operated as a family under the way that my wife would operate if she could. And that is, hey, don't do anything for me. These benefits I get, everybody should get. And if you have this position as county executive, you should now make sure that everybody has the same opportunities I'm going to get, the same quality health care. And that kind of led me to kind of push stuff like building a new regional medical center. It's like, if she's going to get special treatment, everybody should get, and they should get in a quality healthcare system. And so that led me to the public service.
Well, speaking of using your opportunity, I think that you fundamentally changed the conversation in the campaign about violence in Baltimore. Your ad was very impactful. And in that ad, you note that this violence is not getting the attention it deserves because it's young black men who are being killed. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you came to that message and what the response was?
So, you know, as and one of the benefits of doing public financing is you're not so much dependent on, you know, individual corporations to give you money, but you're also not dependent on endorsements. You know, because people can only give you $250. A lot of times in our political dialogue, we see a problem, but we don't say anything because we don't want to offend who's ever in office. Mantra I had as county executive was to senior staff is I wanted people who didn't need the job as senior staff because I want you to tell me the truth. If you need the job, you're going to be reluctant to tell me the truth. You know, and so when I was running, I'm riding through Baltimore City and actually my son was helping out and I'm looking at what's going on. And he said to me, he said, if you were mayor, you would go ballistic. You couldn't, I really couldn't see. And I thought about it. And I was like, you know what? No one is talking about this. If we had 300 murders of white individuals in Howard County, you know, just think about the pandemic, you know, think about opioid and how we reacted. We would use every tool that we had at our disposal. I had 13 homicides in 13 days as a new county executive, and I completely shut the government down. I was like, this is a crisis. I want every tool. Governor O'Malley, I want you to come in here. I want you to help us because that cannot go on. And yet we had it in this city and folks treated like it was normal. Like, hey, you know, the same lip service. And so what I wanted to say is, as governor, you can't. Because if you're not willing to say the problem, you can't fix it. You can't worry about who you offend. The only way the city is going to get out of the situation it's in is it needs help, just like I did as county executive. And so I wanted to speak truth to power and just say, hey, it was what everyone on the street, and the way we came about it is we were talking to people in Baltimore, and they were like, it's a crisis. They said it. You know, if this was anywhere else and these were white kids that were doing this, or another jurisdiction, people would be up in arms. That's what they were saying. And so we needed to say it. And I think the impact this had is for the first time we saw just as we were stepping out is that people were – other candidates were coming up with real, you know, solutions in terms of what they would do around crime. The other thing is you saw a response from the mayor and the governor for something that's been going on. And, you know, I don't fault the mayor. I know what it's like to be an executive and try and deal with, you know, you're taking water from a fire hose, you know. But the other thing I think it did was to say, you know, how in one of the wealthiest states and one of the wealthiest countries in the world, our number one city. Just think about it. Everyone knows Baltimore City when they say Maryland, just like people know Boston, you know, or D.C. You can think about what was going on in D.C. and how it was just changed. For our number one city that everyone knows, our calling card, for us as a state and as a government to say it is okay for a city that's lost about 100,000 residents to be one of the top areas where homicides of mostly young people of color is happening, and we pretend like, oh, well, you know, we need better training. No, we need an all-out approach. And so part of the end of that commercial was we need to declare a state of emergency. And some people were offended. They said, oh, you want to bring in a National Guard? No, it's not about just a state of emergency. When there's a snow emergency, We call it in the county. You'll call it here in Howard County. That means you get extra resources. So it's not just the snowplows. It means we have access to health care. We have access to all of these extra things that the state has. Well, this is an emergency. And so shouldn't we be in there saying, hey, we can use our Maryland State Troopers. We can use, you know, patrol downtown. But we can also bring in more health. You know, use access to those hospitals we have in Baltimore City. We could actually put more resources in our school. We now can say to the rest of the state, hey, this is an emergency, just like we did with opioids. We rushed to our good friends, and I was county executive out in Hartford County and places during opioid. We were out there saying, hey, we want to send you what we have because it's a crisis. That's the same way. And the benefit would be that not only would you turn Baltimore City around, but the complaint that you hear from other jurisdictions, especially Howard County and Montgomery County and our wealthier ones, is all of our tax dollars go toward this area. Well, guess what? If that area in Baltimore City is pulling its weight, just like parts of Prince George's County, and we named it in our Transforming Neighborhood initiatives, we said, hey, these six areas are the biggest challenges we have. And unless we turn them around, we'll continue to send resources over there. The residents hated it at the first time I announced the programs because they're saying, oh, you're telling people we're bad. I'm telling people you're great. But if we don't put the resources in there to turn you around, that's the same thing with Baltimore City. It's the same thing with the county. It's the same thing with Western Maryland and education. But if we continue what we've done, which is to say, you know, please get your act together. That's like, you know, Martin O'Malley telling me, your homicide rates are going up in Prince George's County. Could you get your act together? Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, could you give me some help? Mm-hmm. And that was the essence of it.
Is that part of the challenge? Is it that we need a governor who partners in really thoughtful, authentic ways with the mayor? I mean, is that the part of the biggest challenge that we're seeing?
That is literally the biggest challenge. It's the politeness I was county executive when a lot of this stuff was going on. I didn't challenge, you know, my good friends who were in Baltimore City, or challenge. No one came and challenged me. You know, people were, they wanted to be supportive. You know, Ike Leggett, when he was county executive, had been my professor at law school. And he was calling me saying, hey, I want to help out. I don't want to call you out. But part of what I needed was him to say, you know what? I'm going to publicly go out and say, I need to help this guy. I need to help him with his education reform. I need to help him bring in, you know, MGM because his economy needs it. Now, if that been another, if he was being real polite, he'd have said, yeah, he wouldn't have done anything. Instead, because he did that, he brought votes along with people who said, hey, we haven't been paying attention. They need help. That's the same thing. You know, if Martin O'Malley had worried about, you know, ticking me off or legislators off, he wouldn't have called and said, what can I do? And I wouldn't have been able to say, hey, I really need you here. And so that's what I think has to happen. If we, without it, without having a governor that's partnering at the local level. And Baltimore is emblematic of what is happening around the state. So when people said, oh, you're just talking about Baltimore, da-da-da, Baltimore City, I was like, no. How do you go to somebody in Western Maryland or Hagerstown and say, hey, we're coming out here to help you because we know you need jobs. We know your education system is suffering. And they look at you and say, well, we're a small little place in Western Maryland. If you're allowing Baltimore City to do that, or you're allowing Prince George's County to have 130 homicides or carjackings and or an education system that's subpar, why would I believe that you care about us or the Eastern Shore or Lower Eastern Shore? And so that's the part that got me to run for governor. But more importantly, I think just pushes me in this with the other folks is that, hey, the time for polite conversation is over. COVID showed us all the shortcomings we have in this state and in this nation. and you got very little time, so you've got to go in there and get it done.
You also were a candidate for governor in 2018 and came very close to receiving the Democratic nomination over Ben Jealous. How, looking at this race, the 2022 race and the 2018 race, have you noticed any big changes in the Maryland Democratic Party or in the state that has occurred over those last 4 years?
Yeah, you know, the 2018, this one probably hurts more than 2018. You know, in 2018, it was really, for us, it was that change versus establishment. You know, it was kind of interesting for me. I'd never been establishment before, to be, hey, you're the establishment guy. And Ben was change. And I was saying that a lot of the stuff that he was saying with change didn't make any sense. But I will say this, and here's the difference. He had a message. He had a message. I may not have agreed with the message or I had a different one, but he had a message of here are the things I want to do. I think in this election, it's more about money. You know, who has the most money? You know, who can raise the most? Who's in these positions? And I think that makes it even harder because the dynamics are different. You know, it's more important now to have a message that is going to come in there. And I think, like I said, I think in 2018, you know, there were three of us who were at the top. It was myself, Kevin Kamenetz, and Ben Jealous. I think everything being equal, if God not had not interceded, we would have won because we were clearly ahead the whole time there. But in the end, when Kevin passed and people started the votes, and I'm sure this is part of the question I'll get throughout, is that when do voters start focusing? And this is about the time they start focusing. And normally when you see a shift, it's around a message. Mm-hmm. And by that time, you know, as I said, you know, Mr. Jealous had a message of change. And so people went to that. And by the time we tried to recover from it, it was too late. This time it's been more frustrating because I think that a message about how we move the state forward and how you use all the tools should be what's driving the process. And what we found, especially with public financing and with pushback from establishment, the fear was not having a candidate that would have the money to go on to the general. I'm not saying that shouldn't be the case. But I think that's the difference. And now we're just in a critical point in our state.
If you had to do it all over again, would you choose the public financing route?
So that is a really, really good question. You know, having time to reflect on it, I think I would have, I think I would have done it. I probably would have understood it a lot better. I can't get past the fact that, you know, and this is probably my problem is, as I said, I came into government in 2010 in Prince George's County, and the county executive was on his way to federal prison. And a councilman was on their way to federal prison. And we had a county that had been investigated because of money. Because of corporate money that was put in there, developer money. And so you're starting off with the first thing that people don't trust you. And so the very first thing I had to do was ban developers from giving money to the county executive and county council members, just so businesses and so. So having seen the corruptive power of, you know, money and special interests and dark money coming in, even in the 2018 race, you know, the last minute we had two individuals from San Francisco put $1.5 million into Mr. Jealous's campaign. I ain't mad at him for getting it, but two individuals from out of state came in, could do that. And so to me, if we as a party, and I thought this is where we were trying to push this forward, then we should stand on those philosophies. And I think Nancy and I said, you know what? No, somebody, a major candidate has to be able to do this. You know, if we were low in the polls, and we did it, nobody would care. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you're number two and you're deciding you're going to forego millions of dollars, I think it was the right thing to do. I think I would do it. And I think my obligation from this point is to say to the next governor, the party, we gotta live our beliefs. If we're gonna have public financing, we gotta make sure someone can run for governor. 250 is just not enough to compete when everybody else can go and raise millions of dollars. So somehow we have to get a balance. But if we don't get a hold of it, what you'll see is the same thing you see in some of the good bills that have come out of the General Assembly, where we had an environmental bill that was great. Senator Pinsky put it in, but it's watered down. Why? Because of special interests. Why? Because those folks not only give money to Republicans, they give money to Democrats, and they give money to the Democratic Party.
And, you know, you've flown the plane now. You're going to have a lot of people coming up to you asking, how do we change it? You've sort of hinted at some of these items, but I'm going to give a two-part question. One is, what are the ways that we can change it to make it a more powerful and effective tool? But secondarily, is the real change that needs to happen peer pressure on other campaigns to use it next time?
Wow. I wish we had the candidates here so you can ask them that. because that is a million-dollar question. I think the answer is, until we change how you can raise money and the amount you can raise, you're not going to get anybody else to do it. There are some really good candidates who would love to do this, who are running right now. But as someone said to me, and I thought gave the best answer, I think it was John King, I thought he gave the best answer on this. He said, I'd love to do it. He said, but my name recognition across the state is low. You're starting out with high name recognition, you know, not high enough, but high name recognition. I can't. I've got to be able to get my message out there. So what it says is, nobody wants to risk their run on this if they don't think they're going to be able to get their message out. So it says to me that we, as a state, you know, Larry Hogan was, he's the only person that's done it. But he benefited from the fact that he ran in a primary where somebody wasn't raising, you know, $4 million or spending $3 million or something like that, that you could get your message out in that primary. So I think we have to look at it and say, hey, even if we up it to put the limit at, still, I believe it should be just individuals, not corporations, not special interests. But even if you start looking at, well, maybe we make it $1,000. Because if it had been $1,000, we would be having a different conversation right now. It wasn't that we couldn't raise the money. We had individuals to say, hey, we like your message. You're going up here. But I'm maxed at 250. And if those individuals could have been $1,000 and said, hey, this is when, you know, we need you. Interesting thing, you know, real quick is toward that question. When we announced we were suspending the campaign because we didn't have the resources, but we would try and raise the money, we had the two biggest weeks of raising money online that we'd had. Mm. And so my son, who's the chair of the campaign, said, wow, if we could have had all those 250s a little while ago, but more importantly, if those could have been 1,000 and then it's matched, we would have been up on the air, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that's what we have to push and say, one, we have to change it. And two, I do think we have to pressure individuals and say, especially on the Democratic side, to say, you know what? This is a core belief for us. If Montgomery County is doing it, if Howard County has put this in, if Baltimore County, it's the wave of the future. It's where we should be going. And the only way you're going to see people doing it is to say, hey, we're going to get behind people who do this at the gubernatorial level and at the state. Right now, the state doesn't have an operation, so state senators and state delegates don't operate under it. But I think you have to push that.
So we're not going to ask you again who should be the governor or who should not be the governor, but we will ask you this. What's next for you?
So,
what's on the horizon?
So for me, you know, I've, you know, always been committed to trying to you know, push this state that I love so much forward. One of the things I'm looking forward to getting back to is working with executives at the, you know, local level. So, you know, county executive, county judges, and mayors. And then, you know, I'm going to push hard for a Democrat to be in office, in the governor's office. And so I hope to work with that individual and their team to move the state forward. There are things I, you know, two things I know I'll be working on in terms of policy. I'll be working around healthcare, especially around mental behavior health. And I know I want to do something around, you know, criminal justice reform, especially for juveniles, is something that's definitely needed. So those two areas.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, we're going to go to our elevator questions now. These are questions we ask all of our guests. Mm-hmm. The first one is, what was the last book, movie, and music recommendation you made to a friend or family member? And I know you're coming right off the campaign trail, so you're going to be like, I haven't had a chance to do any of those fun things, but maybe you can recall book, movie, music, just that you would recommend to our audience.
Okay. The book, you know, is probably an easier one because I've learned that you always should read no matter what. Constance Baker Motley, the new book about her is amazing. Mm-hmm. And I've been reading it throughout the campaign, but it's one everyone should read. But just her role, especially in this time, talking about, we talk about what it's like now. But can you imagine being, first of all, a female lawyer going to the South in the 50s? Mm. You're an African-American female, you know. First of all, they never see women lawyers. Mm-hmm. Two, an African-American lawyer was rare. And you're down there and you're defending these cases and just her whole story, so that's good. Music. I listen to a lot of different music, but there's one, Tasha Cobbs Leonard, who's a gospel singer who had some amazing inspirational songs I listened to. So maybe I'll throw that one out there and then my kids will be mad, but I'll throw this one out there. Miranda Lambert's new album.
We'll be happy to hear that. He's a big fan.
Not what I thought you were going to say.
And then a movie?
Movie, let me see. You know, oh gosh, what was the last movie?
We have also been allowing folks to talk about the Netflix series.
Yeah,
that
any
they're
TV
binging.
Shows you want to stream? Oh,
you know, there is one that I had to pause because of the election, but that I've gone back to is The Hour, which is on PBS. That's really good.
Yeah.
So I would say that.
I like that.
All right. What's the most unpopular, benign opinion you hold? It's got to be both unpopular and benign.
Oh, God. Okay.
So I have a new one to prime the pump. I have a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've ever offered this on the show before, but I've definitely put it on Twitter. And it ended up not being that benign. But anyway, people who back into parking spaces drive me crazy. Like, they will hold up everybody in the vicinity going in either direction just to save themselves a couple seconds when they're trying to get out later on.
So you know what? That probably gives me a good one. I think for me, let's see, people who honk their horns.
That's a good one.
My daughter who, you know, went to school in New York is like, Dad, people do it all the time. But when she does, I'm like, honey, all you're doing is making that person nervous and you're not going to go any further. So that would be it.
That's a good one. Yes. That's a very good one.
And I will say, I do not honk my horn if someone's backing in their parking space.
That's a good one.
And then the question we end all of our shows with is, what do we all need to do to elevate Maryland?
Care about, you know, other people more. I think if that's it, you know, I'll end with this. You know, I always quote my wife because she always had the best. She once said to me, and this will get to why I say care about other people more. You know, we believe in public schools, and in Prince George's County, you have some great schools and you have some challenging schools. I remember our daughter, middle child, who's now a lawyer, was struggling. And I decided, you know what, I'm bailing on the public schools. I'm going to private school. And I was a delegate, and she wouldn't let me. And she said, you know what, honey, if every elected official put their kids in the most challenging schools, they would turn around quicker. Mm-hmm. You got to care about other people's children as much as you care about yours. And I never forgot that. And I think that's it. If Maryland, to elevate us, care about other people more, and we'll get a lot things done quicker.
Well, I love that question. Yes. I love it.
And I've loved this interview. This has been, with all due respect to the other gubernatorial candidates that have come on, this has been the one I've really enjoyed the most. And I think that your message is one that is so important, and I'm so glad our listeners are going to be able to hear it. And I'm also so glad that you are the epicenter of Maryland politics right now, because you are an important figure that I'm glad is where you are.
Super important. Every time I talked about the fact that you were coming on the show, everyone, literally everyone, said, oh my gosh, he's so nice. He is such a kind, thoughtful man. And so there's that for you too.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thanks so much for joining us.